This is, to the best of our knowledge, we're on stage at the Wisconsin Union Theater in Madison, Wisconsin, with the Wisconsin Book Festival in cooperation. We have two extraordinary graphic novelists as our guests today. They are here with the support of the Virginia Quarterly Review, whose editor, Ted Genoways, will also be joining us. The Virginia Quarterly Review recently published a supplement, Writers on Writers, which featured a cover by Chris Ware. I highly recommend it. Marjan Satrapi was born near the Caspian Sea and grew up in Tehran before leaving to study in Vienna and Strasbourg. She currently lives in Paris. She is the author of two enormously popular biographical graphic novels about growing up in Iran, Persepolis and Persepolis II, as well as several children's books and two more adult books, Embroideries and the latest, which is Chicken and Plums. She's working on an animated film adaptation of Persepolis. Chris Ware was, I'm told, born in Nebraska, went to school in Texas, but moved to Chicago, where he considers himself a Chicagoan. He currently lives there and works there. His graphic novel, Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth, has received awards both in this country and abroad. He is a contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine's new Funny Pages. Please join me in welcoming Marjan Satrapi and Chris Ware and Ted Genoways. I think that I may have understated it when I said you were both enormously popular. You know which... By the frown on his face, I think you know which one is Chris Ware. I know you have unique comic visions, the two of you. I'm curious to know where they developed. I'm not even sure, Marjan, that you would call your graphic novels comic, but would you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I will call, actually, basically, I will call it comics. I don't really like, you know, this graphic novel stuff. It's like they have considered that, you know, they have considered that since comics for most of the people is reading for children or adolescent or retarded adult, so whatever would not be that, they will call it the graphic novel. But for me, it's comics, you know. I mean, I always say that, you know, a movie, for example, with Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is a really bad movie, and then a movie by John Ford, both of them, they are called a movie. So one of them is really bad and the other one is not. But but still, so, no, I prefer, actually, the term comics to graphic novel, actually.
What about you, Chris? Would you have you accepted the phrase comic book, or is graphic novel a better description?
I much prefer the term comic book because it kind of acknowledges the trashiness of where it all comes from. And to me, the word graphic novel sounds like Lady Chatterley's Lover or something. And whenever I meet people in a general circumstance, like at a party or the grocery store or something, or if they find out what I do, then there's always a hesitation where they're afraid to say, like, oh, so you're a comic book novelist, artist, person, because it's like you don't want to say the wrong racial thing or something like that. You know, like they don't know what the current word is that's not going to offend you. So, I guess graphic novelist is the one that's au courant. So,
well, actually, I find this a great relief because it means that I can ask you about comic books and how you came to write them. Do you, Marjan, have favorite comic artists that you read when you were growing up?
Not really. I really don't come from a culture, you know, where comics were so popular. I mean, the only translation that was in my country, it was Tintin, and I was not very much fan of Tintin. But actually, probably also the reason I never read comics until I was 24 was that really the first experience I had with comic, that was this American comic that would come to Iran, that was in the toy shop beside our house. And I was going to a French school, and my cousin, who was a year younger, was convinced that since I spoke French, I spoke all the languages. So we bought these comics that they were called Dracula. And he told me, can you read them? And I was like, yes, yes, of course. So I was reading them in my way. And one day I decided that in this comic, which was written in order to become Dracula, we had to eat raw chicken. So for a whole summer, my cousin and I, anytime any of our parents would buy chicken, we would stole a piece of chicken and we would eat it raw. And as a result, at the end of the summer, we got worms, both of us. So that was my first relationship with comics. So then I stopped reading until I came to France.
It does make it astonishing that I'm surprised that you were willing to draw them after that experience.
Yes, this is another story. It was a coincidence.
How about you, Chris? Who were some of what were some of the comics that you read?
Well, I had to kind of crawl up through the muck of popular culture, I guess, being raised in a very insular Midwestern environment with television and trash culture, basically, starting with superhero comics, and then I started smoking pot in high school, so then I read underground comics, and then from that graduated to art comics, I suppose, which doesn't sound like a very distinguished kind of educational system to go through, but I think in America, just where it's kind of a distinction between the high and the low comics that, I don't know, I try not to think about as much anymore, but I just grew up reading them, and as my friend Seth has put it, by the time he was in his 20s, he suddenly realized he'd been tricked into being a cartoonist after reading them for so long. So it's I don't know.
Is it the art that drew you first or the story?
I guess it was the art in my case because I never really read the comics. I just kind of traced them like all these kind of muscular men pictures and stuff. Just sort of I was kind of fulfilled this vision of what I hoped I would become when I finally crossed over the line into adulthood, which of course never actually happened. So that was my disillusionment, though. I didn't have to eat raw chicken. I guess it was just like the truth of puberty revealed. So
I'm not sure that eating raw chicken qualifies you to state that you're an adult now, but if you didn't have daily comic strips, if you didn't have comic books to look at, when did you and how did you, Marjan, decide to use comic art as a way of storytelling?
Well, you know, it happened that I came to France in 94, and the first book, for my first birthday, the book that they offered me, that was Mouse of Art Spiegelman. And, of course, you know, for me, I had the vision of the comic, as I said just before. And I started reading this book, and I was so shocked that actually you could write actually whatever you wanted. That is just a question of the media that you're using. And so, you know, I could never decide between either I like to write or to draw, and I like both of them at the same time. And it became like an obvious choice. And, you know, Chris just said before that, you know, people, they always have a problem, you know, to talk to us like, oh, you are a comic artist, etc. I think the relationship that they have with us people is the relationship that people they have with bisexual. Like, you know, since we like to draw and to write at the same time, like, people, they're very comfortable. They're very comfortable if you're a homosexual or if you're a heterosexual. This is not a problem. But if you say that you're a bisexual, it's more of a problem. And this is a little bit, we are the cultural bisexual people that cannot decide. So.
Now, what room are you staying in again?
I'm going to break the line between audience and stage for a moment and ask you, if you would, to turn your cell phones off. I've heard one or two go over the last few minutes, and it would be nicer for our purposes in the long run if they weren't ringing during the course of this. Chris said a moment ago that... Oh, were you turning your cell phone off? Good for you. Thank you.
No, I just had the mint.
Okay. Chris said a moment ago that that people make fun of comic artists and don't know how to respond to comic artists, which is one of the reasons why I think the phrase graphic novelist has become so popular in the last few years. People assume that that gives you some kind of status that comic artists doesn't, which is a shame. But both of you decided, or perhaps in Chris's case, like his friend Seth, was tricked into becoming a comic artist. But Marjan, especially, you decided this was a form of storytelling you wanted to use. And I again, with people in the adult world so firmly opposed to this, I'm surprised, I guess, that it would seem so natural to you. Or was it?
No, it was natural, first of all. And then, you know, I really don't care about, you know, what people can think about me or if they take me for serious or not. And actually, I like it very much that they don't take me for serious because, you know, when you are a real writer, you know, you're always supposed to sit like that and say all these intelligent sentences and you have to be very concerned. Though we have the right still, you know, to laugh and say whatever we want, which is a big freedom. So why not enjoy that?
Of course, both of you do write in complete sentences. The tales that you tell are real tales. It may be that they are black and white drawings or color drawings on a page, but the stories are every bit as real as any prose novelist would tell. What are you doing with your mouth, Chris?
I don't know. I wasn't aware that I was. My wife tells me sometimes I betray my inner thoughts quite dramatically, and I didn't realize I was. So I'm sorry. I can leave if you want.
Actually, I'm not sorry at all because it made me think that you disagreed, that you think that that you had thoughts about the way in which stories are told. There's something about comics that you obviously feel is a better way of expressing your thoughts than it would be to try to write them out.
Well, I just think that certainly the potential of comics is that you have basically every possible visual graphic tool at your disposal, from typography to color to pattern to gesture to even sort of a synesthetic music if you order things properly. And I think that there's the greatest potential for representing the different layers of human consciousness on the page when you have both pictures and words simultaneously. The trick is to not do it in a way that's stupid, I think, and to try to respect your reader. And I'm not, I mean, I sound rather flippant or something. I don't really mean to, but it's, I think if you put your mind to it, you can do it properly. The trick is that it sort of involves reading pictures more than it does actually looking at them as illustrations. So it's kind of a different mechanical approach to looking at images. So
Marjan is nodding vigorously as you're talking. You both clearly agree on this.
Yes. Especially that in his work, I mean, Chris, I mean, especially in his work, I mean, he's really using everything from the type to whatever it is. That's why I admire his work so much. That's why I'm, you know, he's my big hero, actually.
That's very nice.
You can blush. But, okay. You know, but the thing is, what I consider, you know, the comic to be is that it's not really illustration. Like, you wrote your text and you are making some illustration to make your text look better. Is really the narration you write with your images.
Right.
It's whatever you don't write, you draw them. And, you know, you have this international language also that is the image that you can show it to anyone. It means the same to everybody. And you can do so much with these images that, you know, you cannot do with the words. Once in a while, words, they are not enough. Or you need pages and pages to describe a feeling that very easily, you know, you can draw. But, you know, it should really not be considered as illustration. We actually write with our drawings. So is the narration that goes with both of these things, you know.
I suspect everyone in the audience in the theater has a very clear knowledge of the art that both of you produce. Some who are listening to us on the radio may not. Chris, you especially will tell a story not just linearly, but almost as though you need to express the same idea five times across the top of the page, and sometimes it isn't clear whether the storyline goes straight across or whether it drops down and there is a subtext. Do you see the way in which you put the panels on the page as part of the story that you're telling?
Yeah, I try to compose pages in a way that in some cases, especially if the story is being told in the third person with narration, which immediately calls into question its veracity as a story, like to try to reflect the way that I remember things or lie to myself or structure memories and how I see things mentally, how certain images might be more prominent or repetitive than others. as opposed to other ones that are subdued. So if that makes any sense without sounding too pedantic. But
Well, you also will build in things like a cutout model of part of the stage that you're, part of the story that you're telling. Do you build them, first of all, I'm curious?
No, I don't. I might, you know, measure them out and hope that they work and then get an angry letter or two maybe from people who try to build them, which I send my many apologies for. But you're asking me why I do
I'm
that?
Asking you where the idea to add that piece of the story came from.
I think, first of all, I used to like to build paper things when I was a kid, and it just adds another dimension to a story. I can't really think of a specific instance where I used it lately necessarily, but it's another part of storytelling on paper that I think you can use, especially if it's a setting that you're trying to create. Just by simply looking at a flattened out room, it can give you a better sense of the space in which a story is happening. So I don't really, mostly it's just fun. That's, you know.
Of course, there is no way in which a comic can be fully three-dimensional without the participation of the reader. Do you see the comic as two-dimensional when you're producing it, and does that matter?
Well, personally, I don't, but I imagine it actually happening. I don't see comics as, to me, a comic drawing is sort of a, it's the way that we remember things. We remember things in general terms as a general idea, like a line drawing represents sort of, in a way, a word. And I see it in my mind as an actual memory, and I recreate then on the page as close to the rhythms of experience as possible with pictures what I'm imagining. So I don't see it as line drawings in my mind at all.
But what about you, Marjan? Is it a two-dimensional art, or is and if not, where do we find the other dimensions? Where do they come from?
No, it's for me the same thing. For me, the things are actually happening, and actually I play them for myself, you know, like a cycle, you know. I normally in my bathroom, you know, I'm in front of the mirror, and, you know, I just play, you know, what the people are going to do and say. So, you know, it's really, yeah.
But at some point, you have to take that story that you've made in front of the mirror, that is three-dimensional, and find a way to express it on the page that is two-dimensional.
Yes. Well, that's where you draw it, and because the drawing is two-dimensional. But, you know, the fact of, you know, that if we write first or we draw first or vice versa, I think all of it comes a little bit at the same time. You know, it's like, I don't know, a child growing up in a belly, you don't have first, you know, the nose that comes, and then one eye, and then when you have one finger, and then a leg, you know. All of it grows in a way at the same time. And for me, I mean, concerning my work, you know, all of it grows. And also, you know, I never watch myself working. And when I'm working, I'm so much into my work that I never think about how I do my work. So it's very hard, you know, to answer to this.
Well, yeah, the real experience is in the reader's mind. It's sort of like it's almost like a script that you read through or something, or it's like a little imaginary theater happening before your eyes. So it's not the art on the page, it's reading through it, and then the sort of false memories that you're planting in somebody's mind. And that sounds really sinister.
As long as they're good false memories, I guess it's okay.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, I've used this stupid analogy before, but in a way it's almost like sheet music. You read the sheet music, and the music that you hear is the real aesthetic experience. It's not the comic itself. So, I mean, that's sort of a shaky metaphor, but that's more along the lines of at least what I aim for. And I think the closer that you get to a real appreciation of a lushness of a drawing or of a reality of a drawing, then the farther you can get away from that internal experience of reading. But I think comics can go to those both directions, which is what's kind of interesting about it. So,
I wonder, you clearly read other artists, other comic artists.
I only read my own work.
Well, then I'll turn to Marjan, who I know reads yours as well. So. Is there a comic tradition that you feel you come from?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, I really, really love the newspaper comics of the turn of the century up until the 1920s or 30s or so, and then the underground cartoonists and certainly the artists that Art Spiegelman published in Raw. I think it's, I've said this before, but I really feel like I'm part of a bunch of artists who are honestly trying to express something real about reality and experience, and that we read each other's work, like I read Marjan's work or Dan Klaus's work, just to see how they're doing it, and I'll realize that that worked there, and that kind of, it's like it's a developing language in a way that when I went to art school and studied painting, I didn't feel that way at all. I felt like we were all kind of trying to out-clever each other or something. It didn't feel like we were expressing anything or encouraged to express anything about real feelings and experience. So, but I really feel like that's going on in comics. It really feels very, very alive to me. So,
does that same thing apply to you, Marjan? Are there other artists whose work has excited you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even though I say that I didn't come from, you know, from a tradition of comic reading, and, you know, at the moment I started making Persepolis, I almost read, like, two comic books before that, and that was the whole thing, you know, to try to figure out how a comic will work, actually. But, you know, later on, I mean, of course, I mean, the people that he's talking about, I mean, that is, it would be, you know, Spiegelman or Dan Klaus or Chris himself or even the work of Joe Sacco, you know, Charles Burns, all these people, but in a very special way, I'm very, very much fan of the American cartoonists, much more than the European one. Yeah. And it's funny because even before the first time that I came to America, at the time that even I even didn't know that I was going to make comics, you know, every time I show my illustration, you know, to a publishing house, they always ask me if I lived in America before, which was surprising. But, you know, it's something about the American comic, the aesthetic of it, but also, you know, the way that they approach the reality that is much closer to what I am than the comic books that are made in Europe that are different, actually.
There's another aspect of comic art that I'd like to talk to both of you about, and I know you have some experience. Marjan, you are just embarking on the project of taking Persepolis to another medium. It's going to be an animated film.
Yes.
What does that mean to you? I mean, is it still the same story?
Well, I've been working on it since 2.5 years. I'm just looking forward that it's going to be finished, you know, one day. Well, first of all, you know, it's another medium, but it has nothing to do with comics. I mean, people, they think that since you have this world of images and of words, actually, it will be very much alike, which is absolutely not true. And the problem for me is that, you know, I've been making this book. For 4 years, I've been thinking in one way, and then I had to think in another way. So I'm making it with my best friend, who is a really talented, excellent guy. And so we wrote the script, and, you know, it has nothing to do, you know, with the... Well, of course, you know, you can find mostly the story that are in the two books, Persepolis, but the narration is absolutely not the same thing. It has nothing to do with each other. So
even though you started by acting this out in front of the mirror in the bathroom, telling the story and then putting it on the page.
But the only resemblance it would be that, you know, for the direction of the, you know, of these animated characters, you know, I play all of them, you know, in front of the camera, and that will be used by our animators, because I have to say that the animation movie that I'm making is all handmade, is all animation on paper. We don't have any use of the computer. We all of it is handmade. So that's why we have all these people working for us, because, you know, you need 12 images per second, and the movie is 5,400 seconds. So you can just imagine how many images it is. And all of it is handmade. So you know, I act in front of them because, you know, like in a Walt Disney movie, the reason that the head, you know, will not turn like that and it will turn like that is not for the style. Is basically because if you have to make it head turn like that, you have to be very precise in your drawing, because otherwise, you know, the eyes and the nose will go in other direction while when you do that, you know. You just hide everything and you see the movement. But we wanted, you know, I wanted it to be realistic. I didn't want, you know, this, you know, Pocahontas kind of, you know, or the Lion King or whatever. It was out of purpose anyway. But, yeah, it's completely different.
Has working on an animated film changed the way you think about your comics?
Absolutely, because you know, as soon as you have the movement and you have the voices and you have the soundtrack and you have the music and all of that, it becomes another narration. And in a way, you know, it I feel that the God of the universe, like, you know, I have drawn all these 650 characters and they move and they talk and, you know, I decide that they have to lie down and they lie down. This is great. But it's a part of the thing that I also lose, because in a comic, you know, you have all this time also to have, you know, the second and the third and the fourth kind of reading and leave lots of space to your reader to have their own imagination, where here, you know, you have all the images. So all this word of imagination, you lose them at the same time. And also is the fact that, you know, I always work with myself, which was already unbearable, and now I have to work with 100 people, and this is, I mean, now I'm used to it, but for a whole year I wanted to kill all of them every day, so.
Chris, you've been nodding as you've listened to this. You have some experience also of working with comic art in animated form with DVDs, haven't you?
Just a little bit, yeah, with friend Ira Glass and I did a kind of limited animation thing, and I just did something for his new TV show too. But again, it's a really, really different thing, because you watch animation. It's a very passive experience to watch animation happen in front of you, as opposed to comics where you're actually actively reading them. You make them happen in your mind. It's a very different kind of thing. So,
does it take you back to your comics with some joy then?
I don't really associate the words joy and comics too much. When I think of drawing, I try to avoid working as much as possible. But actually, lately, I've enjoyed it a lot more. But that's of no interest to anyone except myself. So, but I just wanted to say, one of the things I really admire about Marjan's way of working is her almost diary-like way of drawing, where as my friend Ivan Brunetti, who's actually sitting out there somewhere, has said, the comics is one of the very few mediums where you can sense the writer's mental state when they were working, which is something I completely try to sublimate in what I do by working in a very cold, flat way. But in Marjan's work, you can really see, like, the way her line and the simplicity of her constructions allows that to be very clear when you're reading it. So,
but. Actually, both of you have. Written autobiographical works. Certainly, Marjan makes no bones about this.
Oh, yes, I do.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yes, I do, because, you know, for me, an autobiography is normally a book in which you want to solve the problem with the people you hate through a book. So, and, you know, people that I don't hate, that I do hate, you know, I even don't talk to them, and I don't care. So, you know, I don't want to solve any problem with anybody that I hate. The thing is that, you know, if I made a book that looks like an autobiography, actually, is that, you know, I came from the point of view that, you know, from the second that I'm not a historian or a sociologist or a politician, and I don't have such a pretension, but I'm a human being who is born in a place, in a certain place, in a certain time, and I just, you know, trust what I have seen. So I assume the subjectivity of my point of view, and, you know, I don't talk so much about myself. Then through myself, I talk about other things, to always say, this is Marjan, that is Marjan talking. And, you know, I didn't want to become, you know, the voice of a nation or of a generation, you know. It's not that I'm humble, but, you know, in that thing, you know, I'm like, you know, I cannot be. I mean, even being responsible for me is not easy. So, you know, being responsible for a whole generation or a whole population is just impossible. So I really use my story as a base, and always to say, this is what I saw. So, you know, if you see it this way, then it's not so much of an autobiography, but using myself, you know, to describe what happened, you know, around me, not so much about myself.
What do you think, Chris? Does that apply to you as well? Is she speaking in a way that you understand?
Yes. But.
What is good is that we agree about everything.
That's right. I was just going to say that I think what she's doing is actually extraordinarily important, especially now with what our wonderful government seems to be heading towards, for her to put such a human face on something like that, I think is incredibly important, and is really one of the only things I think that can countervail against that sort of irresponsible policy or something. But I don't mean to get all, you know, whatever. Anyway, sorry. But my own autobiographical stuff is I generally tend not to go directly towards autobiography. I mean, everything is always eventually, you know, comes from one's own experience, but I tend to write much more fictionally and with characters. So, but sorry, that's a conversation stopper, isn't it? So,
no, the conversation can go on. I promise you, we have more time.
That's your responsibility.
Which is a perfect moment for me to actually share that responsibility a little. You are here today on stage with us because of the generosity of the Virginia Quarterly Review, and we're joined on stage by Ted Genoways, who is the editor of the review. I'm curious, and perhaps you can talk a little bit about this. I know that Ted and Chris have talked quite a bit about comic art. The Virginia Quarterly Review is a literary publication that is known for its prose. It is not known for comic art. But comic art is beginning to be a part of what the American literary tradition is now. Is that there was a beautiful cover that Chris did for the writer's supplement just recently.
Right, and we were lucky enough to publish two sections of Marjan's new book in our spring and summer issues, and we've also been serializing Art Spiegelman's new project. Serializing is not exactly the right term for it. When Art gets pages done that make sense to him, he gives them to us and we publish them. Serializing makes it sound like there's something complete out there that we're just teasing our readers by only giving them bits at a time. But that's part of what I think has been important about getting these things into the journal is that we've tried to have the broadest possible mission in terms of trying to represent human experience. And in reality, the reasons for not publishing this sort of work over the years have always been production obstacles. It was just cost. And when I took over as editor and asked some very basic questions of our printers, like, you know, how much would it cost to print in color instead of black and white, and how much would it cost to reproduce a lot of images and that sort of thing. And when our printer came back to us and said it would cost about $35 a page across the entire print run to add color, everything changed very fast. And so that as I say, historically it was an obstacle, but I think that the reason that you see it breaking down now is that it's not cost prohibitive anymore, and that those distinctions that had emerged during the 20th century I think are breaking down again, and that we're seeing a really sort of lively interplay that's more typical of what was going on, as Chris mentioned, in the 19th century and early 20th century.
Chris, how did you feel when the Virginia Quarterly decided to ask you to write for them? This is not where you would expect Jimmy Corrigan or others to appear.
Well, it was very flattering. He asked me to do the cover for their issue, which then became a supplement about writers on writers, which Ted has pointed out sounds like really bad pornography or something. But
the worst possible pornography.
Right, yeah. And I just did a kind of a gag strip about the history of writing and how other writers influenced each other, and there was some like backbiting spitefulness about it, I suppose. So it was mostly just kind of a, it's not really a serious comic strip necessarily. It's just a series of gags about the history of literature, starting with the oral tradition and then ending in James Joyce. So, which sounds really boring when I describe it, but probably is actually. But
I would just add that in some ways Chris found us. I mean, we were clever enough to, when he was given a gift subscription we had his address. and it was all downhill from there. I think that one of the presumptions that people have that I want to be sure doesn't persist in this forum is this idea of the literary journal being something that somehow, you know, that comic artists have managed to sneak into, you know, that they've
rearranged the furniture.
The barbarians have finally slipped over the gate, right. You know, and I don't see it that way at all. I mean, certainly with these two and with lots of people who are working in the medium right now, I mean, it's at least as literary as a lot of novels that are being published, and I think, you know, you'll find talking to the people who are really good at this that though they're far better educated in the history of comic art than any novelist would be, they also know novels at least as well as a lot of novelists do, and they're writers as well as artists, and that's
great.
Yeah, well, I think so.
You two have come to comic art from different perspectives. Marjan, you said you came to it without knowing much about comic books ahead. Chris, you said that you came to comic art through the alternative comics. Does it matter if comics become an accepted and popular form of narrative expression? Does that make you feel less rebellious? Does it make you feel as though, I mean, is there anything wrong with becoming part of the literary mainstream?
No.
The only thing I'm worried about is it becoming over academized? What's the word? Am I saying it correctly? Probably not.
Academic. We'll go with academic.
I worry about like some of the theory talk getting a little heavy about it, or it maybe being taught a little bit too much in schools. And because one of the things I like about it the most that Marjan already mentioned is that it doesn't have that sort of gaseous, diaphanous cloud of smog around it that, you know, anybody can read a comic and as I've said before, if you read a comic strip and you don't get it or you don't like it, you just think, oh, that cartoonist is an idiot. But if you go to a museum and you see a painting and you think, I don't really like it, you think, well, I must be an idiot. So there's a wonderful approachability about it that I hope is not lost, but I don't think that's going to happen with literary journals. And I mean, The New Yorker has published cartoons for ever since its inception, and I know that was an irritation to writers like John Cheever, who was trying to write, you know, very serious, grim stories, and you know, he knew that it would be next to some gag about a businessman, you know, on a desert island or something like that. So it's just been recently that actually telling stories in comic strip form, which up until very recently was considered a very low form of art because it essentially was a way of just cheating children out of their milk money in the Depression, and kind of stayed at that level for probably about 30 or 40 years. I mean, seriously, comic books are treated as junk. I mean, they were, and they weren't really seen as like a viable way of expressing real deep feeling. But when you really think about it, when you've just got one person sitting at a table doing all this work, you're really the potential for doing something very personal and deep delving is there. So
I remember reading once that The New Yorker, which has published cartoons since the very beginning, called them drawings for the first several decades, as if that gave it a cachet that made it more acceptable among literary people. And now they're quite happy to call them comics, which is what the rest of us always have called them. One of the other things, though, I remember talking to the editor of The New Yorker once, and the cartoon editor, and he said that a drawing is not anything until the caption makes it something. Do you feel that way about the drawings that are part of the basis of your storytelling?
Not necessarily. I mean, you have some drawing that just work with themselves that they don't need, actually, any words. It depends who make them and, you know, but some of them, they're just sufficient for themselves. I don't believe in it. I don't know.
Well, for about 2 years or so, I forbade myself from using words in comics because I realized I was relying on them too much, and I was starting to use pictures as illustrations, and I wanted to use the rhythm of gesture to communicate emotion and story, and I would not allow myself to use any words anywhere, and just to see if I could do it. And I think that was probably the, you know, it sounds crazy basically, but I think it helped me a lot actually. So yes. I think it's kind of important because that's truly the real engine of comics on the page, is reading pictures in sort of a quick rhythm where all of a sudden these figures come to life on the page. So, which is not really what happens when you read illustrated text at all. They just become sort of like little add-ons or frosting or something like that. So,
I know I'm asking you to use words to describe something that you have just said is essentially a visual experience. But can you tell me what the difference is between a series of pictures without words? That how do you change them in order to make them tell a story that they wouldn't have told if you could slap a caption on it?
Well, basically, I just read them over and over and over again, and try to modify them in the way that the try to move the figure on the page in such a way that when I read them regularly, it feels like real movement. Like I might be moving right now, and then I'll put my hands down, or I might scratch my head or something like that. You have to really be kind of a shrewd observer of human gesture and how especially adults lie with their faces and lie with their gestures or sit. And you have to be able to reproduce that on a page in such a way that feels authentic and feels real. Some cartoonists refer to it as acting, but I don't want to really use a theatrical metaphor for it because then it feels a little too godlike or something, and I don't really approach it that way. But you have to really look around. You have to really pay attention, and you have to... But if you do it properly, I think that the psychological subtleties of it are complex enough that you can actually communicate some pretty complicated things. So,
puts a lot of demand on you as an artist to be able to work at making one panel to the next subtly different so that it tells part of the story that the previous one didn't. Well, in fact, comic artists, I mean, that's a lot of work. I look at these things, and it's a lot of work to draw these, one right after another. Everybody's laughing, but it's just extraordinary to me that the amount of time that you have to spend to tell a story. I suppose a writer will also spend a lot of time trying to find the right word, but this is just...
They actually have time to, like, play golf and go boating. And that's actually, I mean, it's sort of true. And I sometimes I feel like, gosh, I don't have any life left to talk about other than sitting here, you know, drawing, which is kind of dangerous. My grandmother admonished me once. She said, you need to get out of the house or you'll lose your source of pollination. That was a good way of putting it.
That's right. Marjan, you're smiling, but you must face the same problem. Drawing a comic novel is a lot of panels.
Yes, but it's also a big pleasure, and that is the pleasure that, you know, we share with ourselves, you know, is a personal pleasure that you have with yourself that is the greatest pleasure because, you know, you can never, you know, you don't have any deception, you know. I'm very happy, actually, when I'm locked in my studio and I work and I work and I work. That is the moment that I feel the best, really. I mean, the outside world, I deal with it and it's fine. But, you know, the moment that I am in my studio, that is the moment. It's such a gracious moment, you know. The moment you're building a story and you're drawing them and, you know, you're just yourself with yourself. It's the best. So, yeah.
Do you get bogged down in the drawing sometimes? Do you feel like you lose your inspiration, or do you feel that you're able to keep your enthusiasm and your inspiration up, or do you feel like at certain points it's just sort of drudgery for you?
No, but once in a while it happens to me, and I get very scared actually, and then, you know, I go a little bit outside and I try to think about something else until I miss it. But at the same time, before starting a book, I really need a time, like 2 months of daily stress. Like, finally, I have so much stress and I produce so much acid that I have so much acid in my stomach that I feel like throwing up all the time, and that is the moment I can start a new book. But this whole acid producing is very important, you know, that then in order to make it. So actually I have a hole in my stomach, which is true.
Well, I'm sorry. Where does it start? Are there pictures first that come to you? Do the panels appear to you before the story begins to develop? Or is it...
Well, again, in my own case, working somewhat fictionally, it's things that just occur to me all day long. I'm constantly thinking about these kind of stories in my mind and these people, imaginary people. I mean, it's a sort of, I don't know, maybe psychological problem or something like that, where I have this extra people in my brain or something like that. And then when I sit down to work and I think I know where the strip is going to go, it completely changes once I start drawing, because then how they're either standing on the page or the room that I've drawn suddenly suggests like a completely different direction for the story, or I'll draw something and realize like, oh, that was the chair that was in the house that I lived in when I was 10 years old, and that reminds me that, you know, my second father did this or that, and then all of a sudden I'm thinking of something else. But it's all organized in the writer's mind in such a way that I think it eventually kind of, it comes out in the wash in a very strange way. It's just, and I'm sure that's what happens with a writer as well, but in cartooning there's something about having it in front of you as a real space where there's almost this sort of like endless loop of creation or something where the drawings suggest things to happen. But in other words, I don't script things ahead of time, which is all I should have said.
Yeah, that's actually something I wanted to ask, because, I mean, it's how does the revision process work? I mean, for writers, I mean, it's simple enough to sort of move things around. It's going to be a little more complex in this medium. I mean,
speaking as an editor?
Yes, yeah. I'm wondering about that thing.
What do you mean, really?
Like, how do you edit? Like, how do you change your stories once they're done if there's some part of it you don't like or you want to go back?
Well, you start again. And you have to make these pages and you have to make all this drawing, and it takes, you know, a very long time, I guess.
How much do you end up discarding? I mean, are there false starts in places that end up being dead ends in the narrative that you...
Well, I don't personally work page by page, you know, like, you know, I have all the thing that is actually in the, with pencil, so I have all my story, you know, with pencil, but, you know, the drawing, they are not really finished. I know more or less what I want to put, you know, each where, but I read it like 5 million times before I'm sure that the story is nice, and then... The whole part that I don't know is actually the drawing that I thought that they would be like that, and suddenly, you know, suddenly the drawing itself, you know, just pushed me to do it in another way. But the thing itself before is prepared, so I don't have any bad surprises, really. So the preparation takes a long time.
I guess that's my problem.
I want to ask you a rude question. Okay. Do you do all your own drawing?
You're asking me. Yes. I wasn't that rude.
Well, I was curious because there are so many panels that are similar. I'm just curious. It would be possible. Marjan was talking about the way in which you react to your own work as it has become an animated feature, and other people are drawing parts of this. I wondered whether it was a part of the whole process, whether you ever allow anyone else, you know, a comic strip artist will often hire people to do some of the fill-in work, to put in the color, but you're both...
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to do it any other way. I'm doing it because that's what I want to do. I never expected to get anything out of this. I just thought I'd be working at, like, a art supply store the rest of my life and, you know, go home and draw my stupid comics and... I would be that. I never really expected to have any, to be able to, you know, survive doing it at all. So, and I don't see it in any way as an industry or as a product or like, gee, how can I build people out of more money? But, you know, I don't think like, oh, I got to get this page out by 5 p.m. You know, I don't think that way. I wouldn't want to surrender that. I mean, I don't want to calcify it at one point and then just keep it that way forever. I want it to, you know, completely change in the same way that my, you know, brain is changing or whatever. It's, you know, it's really the only thing I have going in life other than, you know, a family and stuff. So it's, you know. It's
Do you like the books that have been produced from your work? Does it look right when it comes back to you in printed form?
Well, I plan it as a book, and I do all the book design myself, and I do all the production work, and basically my bedroom is what I can then just send a disc to the publishers, and then they print it. So I actually now I self-publish my regular comic myself because it's just much easier that way, basically. So I've been dealing with printers directly who are actually very nice people, and I really like dealing with printers. They're very straightforward, you know. They deserve more respect.
Actually, when his book, Queen Bee the Mouse, came out in France, that was a guy in my studio that, you know all the types that he made. He made it. He turned it in French. And this friend of mine, he's a complete psycho. You know, like he worked like 20 hours per day for months and months, you know, to finish the whole thing, but extremely happy. But then when Chris, you know, sent an email and he was happy about the book, like it was the happiest day of his life because he got so far, you know, in the production of what he does that... Yeah.
That's like finding out that, like, you know, 10-year-old children are making your shoes or something. I feel horrible. You know? I have no idea.
No, he's not. No, he was happy. No, he's not.
Probably hates me now, though, I'm sure.
No. Everybody was happy.
He's been 6 months of my life. He did an amazing job.
Do you approve of the book as it appears? Is it what you expected it to be when it comes back from the
book? Yes. Normally, it always does. I have the luck in France to be by a publisher who are very, 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 precise in what they publish. For example, when the last volume of Persepolis came out, the cover. The blue cover was not exactly the blue that I chose. So, and they published about 40,000, you know, copy of that, and it was not the right blue, and you couldn't take off just the cover and put another cover. So they destroyed the 40,000 copy, and they reprinted the whole 40,000 other, because I have a publisher that, you know, for him, you know, he loves too much the book and the object of the book itself, so. Thanks God I don't have to take care of that. And every time, you know, for other things when I work with newspaper and magazine, every time I trusted them, it ended up that my colors, they were not my colors, and, you know, they just printed it in no matter what way. But, you know, it's impossible, you know, to want somebody else, you know, making your comics for you. It's just not possible, you know. As for Chris, you know, when I wrote the two Persepolis, people, they were saying, yes, write the Persepolis 3. And, you know, if I wrote it like, you know, Marjan in Paris now, you know, of course, you know, you can make money out of that. But, you know, once you have made two books and I have already said what I had to say, I expressed myself, what is the point of continuing? I mean, the challenge is to do something that I have never done before. That's why I made the last book, Chicken with Plum, with a structure that had nothing to do, because suddenly that was the interest of, and if I have to say the story in another way, how I will manage, and the intellectual and artistic challenge is so much more interesting, you know. And at the end, it pays, you know, because, you know, we are considered like artists with integrity and this thing, so at the end, we are even not poor, so it's fine.
If I just want to, you're asking, I guess, about book design too. I think it's really important, or at least in my own case, I try to think of the book as an object and how, as a three-dimensional object too, backwards and forwards, and what's in the very center. And sometimes Marjan did this with her most recent book too, where the first page is then repeated almost towards the end, the structure of the page and the rhythm and the composition, which is something that's peculiarly endemic to comics, I think, alone as a medium, where you can structure a book that way, where almost there's things going on almost four-dimensionally between the pages. And there's something about books that I really like that allows you to do that, where other media it's almost impossible. So, where you can flip back and forth and go back and forward in time, and you can actually really... You can't do that in a film. You just have to... Sorry, I can just sit here and just blather like a fool.
Hardly. One more question on this subject before we go on. You both have been published in other languages. And I know in your case, Marjan, you speak at least both French and English. Does it change the story? I know most of the story is told through the art, But there is there's a different sensibility in different cultures, and there's different ways of using the English language from the French. Does it change the reader's perception of your work?
Well, of course, it always changed a little bit. But, you know, I mean, I had the luck that, my editor, Anjali Singh, she also translated my books. And, you know, we were very close. I mean, she knew me very well. And we could talk a lot, you know, about the translation. So, and also I could read English. And, you know, we had lots of discussion. And, you know, she knows me also very well. So I knew that, you know, what she translated was the best translation that you could give. At the same time, you know, in French we have this expression, we say that the translation is like a woman. She is either beautiful or faithful. It cannot be the both at the same time. So, I mean, actually I go more for the beauty than for the faith. And for the other languages, the big shock that I had is when the book was actually published in Arabic and in Hebrew, not in Persian yet. And it was because they read from right to left. And so all the images, they flip. But the image that works, you know, from left to right, it doesn't necessarily work the other way, you know. Because, you know, when I have this frame and, you know, you have the first sentence that is written, you know, up in the left side, because we read here from left to right. So it's normal that you read that and then the next. But then you flip the image. But the drawing, you know, and that it goes, you know, it works on one way. If you flip it, you know, once in a while, it doesn't work at all. So it was very odd, you know, to open the book and have all the images flipped on you know, in the other way. But I didn't look too much into it because I got kind of a nausea. So, but it was a shock, yes.
Chris, do you think you could take the artwork that you've done during the period when you were purposely not using any text and publish it in another language and have it mean the same thing?
I don't know. Probably. I would think that, I don't know. I guess it would depend on, like, cultural signifiers and stuff like that. So I would hope so. I would hope that it would be, you know, readable universally or something. But I can't read any other languages. I'm a product of the American educational system, and I'm... So I have no idea whether any of the translations of my books make any sense at all. So,
oh, the French one—they're good. I can tell.
Is it good?
Yes.
Okay.
This is a comfort.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us, Chris Ware and Marjan Satrapi.
Thank you.